People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. More than a decade ago, journalist Jessica Barrett penned a column asking whether it was time to leave Vancouver. It would go viral and reportedly be the Vancouver Courier's most read story of the year. That's according to the paper's digital successor, Vancouver is Awesome. Not long after, Barrett found herself in Calgary, where housing costs were lower. But a sense of home was slow to materialize for Barrett after leaving her community behind. Some of that personal story is mixed in with a macro view of housing in a new book from Barrett, called No Place Like Home, The Missing Keys to Our Housing Crisis. It shares stories of housing and home from across the globe. It also suggests that in North America, views of housing as an asset have fundamentally changed the way we think of home. Now, all these years later, Barrett is headed back to Vancouver. She found time in the midst of a move to speak with me about housing and home.
My name is Jessica Barrett. I am an author and a journalist and a person just trying to find a place to call home in our insane housing system.
And if you're trying to start talking to someone about housing, where do you start?
Oh, well, I kind of joke, you know, I've been doing a couple book signings and things like that in the last little while. And I kind of joke like, oh, you know, have you heard about the housing crisis? And everybody turns around, of course I've heard of the housing crisis. I'm like, well, I solved it. And then you got to get a big chuckle because of course it's such a huge problem. And then from there, it's sort of an entryway into people will just start telling you their experience of housing because our housing system and our housing crisis, what I've learned through researching this book and talking about it, affects everybody, even people who own a single family home that has accrued massive wealth and are very safe in their housing. Everybody has an opinion about it. Everybody feels like it touches them in some way, whether it's like, you know, encroaching density in their neighborhood that they don't like, or the idea that their children might never own a home, or the fact that they're struggling with their own housing security. I guess I don't as much talk to people about housing as I mention housing and they talk to me about it because it's everywhere for everyone.
Well, what are some of the things people are the most keen to bring up with you when they're talking to you about housing?
I mean, it really depends on their point of view and where they're situated about it. I hear a lot from people who are, you know, like in an established neighborhood and feel like they are under siege from development and density in their cities and don't see the connection between that and housing insecurity or housing security for other people. And don't see that there's a problem getting solved that way. Which I think there is actually is something to that. I don't know if that is the best way to solve the problem in the way that we've been approaching it. And then I also hear from people who are, you know, struggling with their rent or like young people, especially like Gen Z, like they will just kind of like scoff at the whole, like even the idea of ever having a home for them, their own house that they would own is so far out of comprehension for them that it's like, they just laugh at it. You know, it's really across the board. And, you know, I hear from people who've struggled with homelessness and I hear from people all over the map. Every single person has a story to tell about our housing system and how it has wrought some sort of trauma in their life and disrupted their ability to feel at home in their housing.
And that is one of the big themes you touch on in your book, the link between home, a house where you live, and the idea of home as in a community where there are other people that you spend your life with who help each other out. And you've suggested that the way in North America we think about the houses that we live in is kind of getting further and further and further away from this idea of home as a place where we kind of form community and really like live in the fullest sense of the word. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, and I think that's why I came to the conclusion that, we can't solve our housing crisis until we solve our crisis of home. And by that, I mean, we've really gotten very far away from an idea of home that is more holistic and includes more than just the building that you live in. If you were lucky enough to, in fact, live in a building and not a tent in an encampment. And I think someone that I talked to, a mentor of mine, put this to me as like the math problem. We've been trying to solve the housing crisis through numbers alone, like X amount of units of housing. And it doesn't really matter where they are, how big they are, how they feel, how they look, what, it's just let's get as much housing built as quickly as possible, wherever we can put it, as fast as we can. And what that's actually done is not only has it produced a lot of housing that it turns out people don't really want to live in. We've looked and we can look to the condo crash in Vancouver and Toronto for evidence of that. People who have the money to afford that type of housing are choosing not to live in it because they don't want to. And the people who may very well want to live in it still can't afford it. So it's not really solving the problem. Yeah, so it's led to that kind of like that math thing has led to this mismatch between demand for housing and the housing that's being provided and a big waste of resources. And on the other hand, the way that we're going about sort of shoehorning housing into communities that, do need to accept some density but are having a hard time with it, they feel like this has been rammed down their throat. And that's actually leading to people to feel like they're being unhomed or they're being pushed out of their home or their homes are being taken away from them, even though they're not being displaced. And then that actually leads to a bunch of pushback, things like restrictive covenants that ensure that no additional housing will ever be allowed to be built there, even after the people who live there now are dead, or lawsuits against cities. Like, we're just not solving this problem very well because we're not understanding that home is actually not a physical thing that you live in. It is a feeling. And you have to start with the feeling. How are people feeling about where they live now? How are people feeling about the changes that may need to happen in their neighborhood to accept more housing? How are people feeling about the fact that they are unable to find a place to live that feels like home, even if they may be sheltered? We kind of have to reverse engineer this, start with the feeling of home, and then figure out what type of housing facilitates that and contributes to that. Because right now, we're not acknowledging that. We're kind of saying that people shouldn't feel the way they feel, which is, if you've ever had a conversation with any person in your life about that and told them that their feelings are not valid, is the first way to get someone to get their back up and start to dig in their heels to whatever they're saying. And we're not getting to the solution that we need to get to here. So I think we really need to look at introducing some emotional intelligence into the way that we produce housing and the idea of home as a feeling, which is brought about by things like a sense of belonging, a sense of attachment to place and landscape and climate around you, a sense of familiarity, a sense of safety and security. These are all the elements of home that I started to dig into in the book and really explore and found that these are the things that need to be in place before anyone can feel at home. And it really doesn't matter what the shape of the housing is, because if those things aren't there, they won't feel at home.
I really want to dig into a lot of the details you spoke about there, but I think to be able to do that well, maybe we have to start with, okay, so if those are the things you want to see in the way we approach housing, well, what is the way we approach housing right now on the level of like when a new, whether it's an apartment building or a single family home or some condos, when those are built, what is the way that they're built?
So this is where, the idea of the for-profit housing market really is the name of the game in Canada. I mean, it's something like only 3% of housing built in Canada is non-market or non-profit, which is far below the OECD average of 7% and much farther below the average in countries like Europe, or places in Europe like Denmark or countries that have like a high percentage of social housing. It's more on the order of 15 to 30%. So here's the numbers mumbo jumbo, but basically, because we've relied so heavily on market-based housing for so long, for almost 100 years since the beginning of our housing policy, the one motivating factor that we have to get housing built in this country is profit. And the problem with profit is that you can, at the end of the day, it dictates what gets built, where it gets built, how many units are there, the shape of those units, and also discounts a lot of other, the feelings about home, the home feelings get kind of pushed to the wayside because it's like, well, it doesn't pencil if we do that. We can't build courtyard apartments that give people green space or spaces to connect with their neighbors because we could be putting X amount of extra units in that space and then making X amount of extra profit. And so that's, that as the guiding factor, not only is it sort of, I would say, like kind of poisoning the well, because as soon as you do go to build housing, even if you do have the best of intentions, even if you are like a small neighborhood developer and you live in your community and you want to do the best you can for your neighbors, people are automatically going to look at you and go, well, you're just doing it for the money. And they're not going to engage in a conversation with you around how to do that well. And on the other hand, what it starts to do is it's pushed up the value of land in Canada so high because housing has become this asset, this financial investment, this financial tool that people living in homes that they, bought to house their lives start looking at them as a financial asset, a return to be cashed in down the road. And it actually affects how people live in those homes. So for instance, how often do you hear from people like, oh, I'm renovating my kitchen for resale, or I'm going to make, decor choices in my home. I'd really love to paint like a wild, bold color, but I'm going to paint it beige because that's what the market wants. Or people who move into a home and buy it thinking I'm going to only be here for 3 to 5 years until the market is favorable and then I'm going to sell it and move on. And what that kind of does is really kind of erode a sense of permanence and a sense of grounded and rootedness for people. One of the big elements of home that I talk about in the book, and I think the most important one, is time. You need to spend time in a place for it to feel like home. And the longer you spend in a place, the more it strengthens the other elements of home, like a sense of place attachment and a sense of belonging and a sense of familiarity. But if you've got one foot out the door as soon as you arrive, you're not going to put the, effort in to do those things, to get to know your neighbors, to get to know the community around you, to be, contributing to the community around you. So if you're only looking at your house as a financial asset that you're going to like pull up stakes and move and realize one day, you're kind of shortchanging your life, really, your life in that place that could be a home.
This is People First Radio. My guest is Jessica Barrett. She's a journalist and the author of No Place Like Home, a book exploring the housing crisis. Around a decade ago, Barrett penned a viral column, Is It Time to Leave Vancouver? She would end up moving to Calgary, though she's now in the process of heading back to the West Coast. And you've suggested that a substantial amount of public money is being pumped into the market-based housing system to keep it afloat. But even with that, we're still in a situation where there are so many people who perceive that they could never be able to afford to own a home, which is kind of presented as that's the ultimate goal. Can you elaborate on that whole idea?
Well, we're trying to do two contradictory things with our housing system, and they're just not compatible goals. On the one hand, we want housing to be a profitable endeavor for developers, and we also want it to be, a financial safety net for people who buy their homes and want to use it for their retirement or whatever it is. On the other hand, we want people to be able to be housed and achieve the goal of home ownership or, whatever it is to be, safe and secure in their housing. But the thing is, you can't have something be a continual financial investment that returns on that investment for people continually going up in value, because that's what markets do, is they exist to produce profit, and have it be accessible for people who don't yet have that asset. Like you just can't have it. And so what our government has been trying to do basically since the beginning of this housing or housing policy in the 1930s is to try to keep the housing market kind of like bumping along and trending upwards. So it kind of swoops in with, programs to keep people in the market and help people get into the market by things like tax-free first-time home buyer savings accounts or cuts to GST if you're buying a new home. We're seeing this now in BC with this recent announcement that the federal government and the province are going to buy unoccupied condos from developers and ostensibly turn them into affordable housing. But what that does is it actually like falsely increases, keeps the bottom of the market going up and up and up. And so we never will allow our housing market to crash. You know, we never allow it to correct truly to where it might be without government interference, because that would bankrupt developers. It would bankrupt people's own nest eggs. It would be financial catastrophe. But the other side of that then is that we have to continually pump money into to the other end of the market to increase demand or to produce demand. Because when housing has reached where it is now, where it is so expensive that so many people just simply cannot access housing on a regular income, you have to do things like come in and offer tax cuts and offer things like, you know, longer mortgages and more access to credit, and essentially allow people to take on more and more debt to keep the whole thing afloat. And I mean, where we're at now is sort of the inevitable outcome of that system. I think for the first, let's say, you know, 60 years or so, this was sort of something that the government could keep afloat. But it's now got to the point where prices have inflated so very high that the amount of money that our government is required to continually pump into housing is hamstringing other parts of our society and other parts of our culture. We put so much money into housing that the amount of, you know, credit available to people is so low in other areas of their lives. So for instance, I've read reports that, you know, business productivity in Canada is really suffering because there aren't loans available for small business people to do things like buy new technology or invest in IP or, you know, expand their workforces, because all of the available credit is going to people's mortgages because we need so much money to pay for our housing system.
Well, another piece you touch on in the book that many others have mentioned to me is this idea that for a period of time, Canada was in the social housing game in a much more substantive way, and 30 years ago, sort of more or less fully got out of that. And now, a few decades down the road, maybe the effects of that are kind of obvious in the country. What do you think it's important to know about that situation?
I think it's important to know that the solutions are out there because we have had them before. Like we have approached a housing system that worked for many more Canadians in, you know, the period that you're talking about is sort of between the late 1960s and the late 1980s, early 90s, where we had federally funded co-op housing. And co-op housing is not only incredibly successful, proven throughout the world, but also in Canada as something that people really want and people and that really works. And so all the co-ops that were built in those decades, and we built between 16,000 and 20,000 units of affordable housing per year during that time, which if you compare it to sort of affordable housing targets now, which are things like the most recent resurrection of the co-op housing funding in Canada accounts for 4,000 units between now and I think 2030, right? So the numbers are wildly askew, but you know, we have this model that is still exists. People still live in co-ops, and there are wait lists at everyone in the country that works. And we could be funding that instead of market housing, but we're choosing not to. And so this idea that the, you know, someone I talked to called it market fundamentalism. The idea that the market is the only way out of our housing crisis is just fundamentally flawed because it's our over-reliance on the market that got us into this mess, and it isn't going to get us out. It's like the definition of insanity. We keep doing the same thing over and over again, hoping that this time it'll be different. And it's also just a wildly inefficient way of creating affordable housing. You know, if we're doing things like bailing out developers and when their projects, you know, have gone into bankruptcy or whatever to create affordable housing. Well, first of all, we had to have a housing crisis for that to happen. We had to wait for the market to crash. We had to have the government come in and bail them out, give them all this funding when we could have just given that funding to a nonprofit housing provider or a cooperative or another community-led solution and just built the affordable housing. So I think, you know, it is time for the pendulum to swing back. And I'm hoping to see that in a big way, but I also think that we need to demand it. And I think one of the reasons that we're not doing that is because we don't necessarily know what's possible. We haven't, this idea of this era of social housing in Canada has sort of been buried and sort of erased from people's memories. Like even sitting politicians don't really know what co-op housing is or what social housing is or why it's important. And we need to kind of bring that back to the forefront for people, which is why I wrote about it a lot in the book.
And your coverage of this issue took you to other countries. You went to Austria, to Germany, to Zimbabwe. What were some of the lessons you learned about how things could be different in housing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest takeaway for me from all three places, which are such different places, so, you know, we've got Vienna, which is kind of like the gold standard, like the rock star of social housing, where over half the city lives in some form of subsidized housing. And you've got Berlin, which is sort of in the middle, where they've got a very strong tenants movement and a government that is sort of being forced to acquiesce to those demands. And then you've got Zimbabwe, where the government's kind of not really involved in housing at all. You know, the government is struggling to just get, you know, streetlights to work. And the key to all of this is communities. The key to all of this is neighbors and neighbors turning to each other to create a sense of home, and in many cases demand the type of housing that enables that and that, you know, allows for that sense of home. You know, in Vienna, a lot is written about how Vienna does the financing of its system. You know, how does it pay for it? And it's through, you know, various levels of taxation and things like that. But what I was really interested in is that Vienna also realizes that building housing, it doesn't really matter how beautiful and sustainable and affordable it is if people don't feel connected to each other and don't feel connected to their communities. So they actually have a very widespread, a very well-oiled program of social work and sociologists and social cohesion that they work with, that they facilitate communities. And they do this by providing spaces for neighbors to come together and have cooking classes or homework clubs or gardening, or there's even a citywide renters choir. And, you know, when they go to develop new areas of the city, there's an office that, you know, comes in and physically sits in the neighborhood that allows people who are, you know, in established communities to come in and talk to people about their feelings about change and help accept the new neighbors that are coming into the community and help those two groups of people gel. You know, in Berlin, I found that, you know, Berlin really wanted to have its existing housing used better and regulated better, because it found that its housing crisis was being exacerbated by the fact that a lot of social housing in Berlin had been sold to corporations, faceless corporations that are multinational REITs or whatever. And they were putting a lot of pressure on the government to buy those units back, and it's working. And the way that they did that was by turning to the people around them and everyone who was having, you know, struggling with the rents, and creating widespread protests, but also joyful protests and sort of, you know, community gathering points where people could come out and get to know their neighbors, and then maybe also go and collect some signatures to change the laws, right? And it's really about providing a joyful, connected way to claim your city with your neighbors. And that's what I found in Berlin. And then in Harare, you know, Harare was really a matter of just communities coming together and almost being their own governments and their own banks, you know, providing or coming up with ways to pool their finances too, so they could have large pools that they could give out as loans so people could build their own housing and upgrade their own situations in slum communities with almost no, you know, almost no amenities and almost no, oh, I'm forgetting the word for it, infrastructure. There we go. Almost no infrastructure. And you know, when the government's not going to do it for you, then the community has to. And I think that in all three cases, those are things that we can really take away in North America, because I think we've become quite complacent with housing and with homes. We sort of sit back and expect, you know, the city will do it, the government will do it, the government will fix this problem for us, or the private sector will do it. And we've kind of either relinquished our role or actually been prevented from, you know, building our communities and building the housing and building the kinds of neighborhoods that we want to see ourselves, which is kind of a newer phenomenon, because for most of human history, you know, how cities got built and how communities got built is that you'd come and you'd, like, you know, rock up next to the next person who put a house up and start building a house and start shaping the community physically together. And I think we kind of need to get back to that.
Well, I imagine in the Canadian context, we call it a housing crisis, but there are probably three groups that are maybe the biggest of, on the one hand, people who maybe bought a home 20 plus years ago, and now it's more or less paid off. And so they really have reaped some kind of windfall, either in the fact that they live in a $1 million asset they didn't pay $1 million for and are kind of insulated from having to pay whatever the excessive rents in their neighborhood would be. On the other hand, you have people who feel like they could never afford to buy a home almost no matter what, but they're still stuck paying for the high cost of property through the rents. On the third kind of level are maybe people who have been able to recently buy a home, but it's going to cost them every single penny they have ever saved and will ever save in their life. And if the market were to crash, it would be perhaps devastating for them and almost worse. How do you envision kind of those three disparate groups ever getting enough on the same page to be able to take some kind of huge collective action in what you feel would be the right direction on this?
Yeah, I think we need to reframe the way that we talk about housing and changes to neighborhoods in terms of what people stand to gain instead of what they stand to lose. And I think we need to start focusing on things that unite people. Everybody wants a safe and stable home. I have yet to meet a person who's like, I love living in chaos. Like, I thrive living on the street. No one says that. Not like, you know, everybody wants a beautiful, safe, connected community to live in. What that looks like for people is different. And we have kind of been sold this narrative, or this narrative has been very intentionally crafted throughout Canadian housing policy, of the idea of a good home is one that is separate from your neighbors, a single family home set far back from the street, quiet and private. And what we need to do is kind of dismantle some of that, because at the same time, you know, we're also very lonely. That's a very lonely way to live. And I can say that as someone who's currently moving out of a single family home back into a multifamily, because I found it incredibly isolating. And so, you know, the pushback from people who are living in these houses that are paid off and they've, you know, they're on, like, we'll say, like, the winning side of the housing spectrum, is that they don't want to feel like they're losing that sense of home. But also what those people do need is, as well, is places to perhaps downsize in their neighborhoods, where they can actually change their housing needs as they age without losing their sense of home. And I think if we actually put it to them that way, they actually might have, and also gave them an opportunity to participate in designing that housing, maybe even financing that housing with some of their housing wealth, they might start to come around, or maybe enough of them would start to come around that we could start to see change. I think it's very different when you say, like, we're going to put a bunch of apartments in your neighborhood because we need a bunch of housing for renters or whatever, is a very threatening thing to say to a lot of people. And whether they have the right to feel that way or not is kind of irrelevant, because they just do. They just do. You know, changes to our homes are perceived as threats. And so if we can start from the idea of, like, people are going to hate change, and our job is to help them work through that change and see why that change is necessary, I think you can bring more people on board. So, you know, maybe it's things like, but this is also a change that could benefit you. We could allow you to help design a place that you want to live, and you can stay in your neighborhood forever, and also make room for your children and grandchildren to live in this neighborhood. And so I think that there is, you know, some commonality that to be found, some common ground to be found here. And I don't think that, I think we're kind of asking the wrong questions as well around, the type of housing we should build. Like, very often our consultation with communities is, it's like adversarial right off the bat. Do you want to do this in your neighborhood? Yes or no? And the answer is almost always no. Right. So it's automatically, it's you against this faceless group of other people who want to infiltrate your neighborhood. I think the questions we need to be asking are how. How can we create a neighborhood where everyone is welcome? How can we change the neighborhood without you feeling pushed out? How can we create space for people who need to live in this neighborhood for generations to come? How can we create housing and pay for housing that isn't going to, yes, maybe put a roof over people's heads, but as you said, bankrupt them for their entire life, right? How can we create a city that is much nicer to be in because there aren't encampments in every public park, right? These are the questions that we need to be asking, and they invite more collaboration from people. And I think that that's, inviting people to see what they stand to gain from change and not just lose is a real opportunity for us.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm speaking with Jessica Barrett. She's the author of No Place Like Home: The Missing Keys to Our Housing Crisis. I asked Barrett about a tendency in housing discourse to characterize people as either NIMBYs or YIMBYs, who uncritically and reflexively are either against or in support of new housing, regardless of context.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that, the impression of people on the ground, and that's really why I wanted to write this book, because I felt like the dialogue that was happening, in the media and among academics and experts, sort of the high level around, best approaches to housing and things like, yeah, luxury housing does open up, more affordable housing because of a thing called a vacancy chain. It's like, but people living in a neighborhood that are looking at a huge development going up next door, and there used to be a garden, and now there's going to be a three-story or five-story wall, don't care about a vacancy chain. They don't see that, this idea of like, this is where I have to get back to the idea of like, we need to start talking about home as an emotional topic for people, as a feeling, and things that and how people feel about their homes is going to dictate the actions that they take. It's going to dictate whether they accept or reject something. It's going to dictate whether they resist change or, become involved in it. And we kind of reduced it to sort of like, yeah, like the math. I the YIMBY side of things, I think about as sort of like, there is a group of people out there who kind of look at housing the way that some people eat, just a boneless, skinless chicken breast, like the way that like food is just fuel for them and not a sense of enjoyment. And there are a group of people that see housing that way, where it's just like it's housing is housing. And what does it matter what it looks like or what the setback is or what the design is? And then there's most everybody else, I would say, which is the majority of people who look at it as sort of like, well, but I want my meal to feel nourishing and comforting and enjoyable. And I want, and it's an experience that I share with other people. And when we eliminate that from the conversation and just be like, well, what, look at this graph. And this graph shows that X amounts of luxury units in this community led to an X amount of, more available rental at the low end. People just don't relate to that because it isn't what they're seeing next door and it isn't what they're feeling. And I can give an example of the neighborhood I'm just moving out of in Calgary. We moved into that neighborhood. That was the first home that I bought with my partner. And we moved in, and we were so privileged and lucky to do this, moved in after renting, after a rental home got basically, we got dem evicted. And after that, I was really traumatized by that because that had happened after getting priced out of Vancouver, moving to Calgary for more affordable housing, finding an affordable rental that I loved, and then getting kicked out. We bought this house, and right away, there was this redevelopment permit for the entire block of the house that we had just bought to put up luxury townhouses, which was exactly the housing product that I got kicked out of my previous house to build. And so I came in with this trauma of having been displaced. And right away, to this development proposal beside me, was like, absolutely not. Absolutely no way. Everyone is coming in from, this is what I mean when I say that there's trauma that has been wrought upon people from all different sides of our housing market. Like people really do feel like they're just surrounded by chaos. They have no control, and there is no safe, permanent sense of home. And so, yeah, I think we need to realize that that is the experience of the people on the ground. And when they see, a row of beautiful older homes that they appreciate. You know, they're not their homes. They don't live there, but they love the garden or they love the design or they love the architecture. And then those homes are bulldozed to put up a row of not particularly attractive townhouses that are renting for a very high rate and then are quite often unoccupied for quite a long time, which is what is actually happening on the ground for most people. They do not see the connection between the sacrifice that they're being feel like they're being asked to make and the greater good that they're being told that this is contributing towards. And so I think this is where things like non-market housing and social housing really do have an important role to play. Because if we can put in things that actually are affordable, that people actually move into, and maybe are also designed with input from the community. And I don't mean that in terms of like, you know, the yay or nay input that we have now, like you show up to a public hearing and you give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down, but more of the like that question of how can we make this kind of housing palatable to you here in this community? How would we make something that you might want to even move into? Then I think that we start to open up those doors a little bit to see that A, this greater good that we're being asked to contribute towards is actually being achieved. The housing actually is affordable. People actually are living there. And B, we feel a sense of pride that we had a role to play in that. And I think that's the challenge ahead of us is how to do that.
Well, one of the big, if it's fair to call it this, YIMBY points is that like if we build more housing, you know, even if it's luxury housing or whatever, people are still going to need to rent it eventually. And you know, that will eventually drive down the prices for everyone. But as you've suggested, there are many, many luxury condos sitting empty, figures saying more than 4,000 in Vancouver right now. I know you've talked about the government's recent announcement that they're going to buy a bunch of those. The details on that plan still haven't really emerged. But do you have any sense of like how it is tenable that there could be for an extended period of time thousands of luxury homes or condos that are just sitting empty? Like, why don't they have to be rented out at lower rates?
Well, because they're privately owned. I think that's the thing. Like, you know, I think so. Just to kind of a few data points, if you'll allow me to put on my data nerd cap for a moment. You know, we talk about luxury housing opening up housing at, you know, the lower price points. There is evidence to show that this can happen, and it can. One of the things that it relies upon to happen is that the housing at the lower price point actually remains in place while the luxury housing is being built. And that doesn't happen in Canada very often. In fact, more often than not, we lose more affordable housing than we are building. So, you know, that new luxury high rise goes up in the place of, you know, an existing walk-up apartment building that was built in, you know, the 1960s or 70s, where the rent is naturally occurring affordable housing. And maybe that walk-up apartment building only had 20 units and the new high rise has 200. But the people being displaced from those 20 units are not moving into the new building with 200. You know, they can't afford the rents there. And so now those 20 units have nowhere to go because that is the type of housing that is disappearing as we build luxury housing in its place. And so this idea of the vacancy chain doesn't really hold water in Canada the way that we do it. It only really works if you build the luxury housing in addition to the affordable housing that already exists, not in replacement of the affordable housing that already exists, which is what we tend to do. So yeah, it doesn't really hold water. And then at the same time, how can they stay empty? I mean, this idea that flooding the market, you know, what I called the math solution, so the numbers only solution, just build as much housing as you can, wherever you can, whatever it looks like. This idea that we're just going to flood the market with so much new housing that the price will plummet is kind of preposterous because we're seeing that that's actually not what's working because these companies aren't just going to start selling at a loss. They're not going, what they would prefer to do, because many of these companies are larger corporations and they have access to all of this funding through, you know, the programs I talked about before, through government financing and credit and shareholders and international investment. And they can just hold on to these units until the market rebounds. And they can choose to then rent them out then or sell them because they don't want to devalue their product. And so they would rather hold them empty than rent or sell them for a rate that people can actually afford. And then that's where you get the situation, you know, that BC has right now where the government is stepping in to buy them. Because clearly the individual people who might want to buy them aren't or still can't because they're not, that price hasn't been lowered low enough to where people can actually access it. So it's like housing is not lollipops. It's not popsicles. It's not a, you know, a fidget spinner or some sort of fad toy that like once everybody starts making that just there's so much on the market that, you know, the price will just plummet. It's not like that because the cost of land, the cost of building is so high right now that even developers who want to sell at a more affordable rate simply can't because they have to make a profit. That's their job. For-profit developers, that's what they do. That's what they're there to do. So if we want to have affordable housing that is, you know, within reach of people, we can't rely on for-profit developers to do it. That's just not their job. That's just not their goal. And quite frankly, it's an unrealistic expectation.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation today on housing?
Yeah, you know what? I think it's so interesting because I end up talking a lot about housing policy when it comes to the book, because I think it's much harder to talk about home and the concept of home because it is quite intangible. And for this, I do really urge people to pick up the book because I do talk about the feeling of home a lot more, and especially in my own personal story and the stories of other people that I share. But I also want to point out for people that, you know, your show is about, you know, the social determinants of health and public health, right? The healthiest neighborhoods. I'm going to start again. The biggest indicator, I'm the mother of a five-year-old. My kid is 5 and a half right now. And the biggest indicator of a child's overall life satisfaction, overall health, overall economic status, career prospects, education in life, it's not how good the schools are in a neighborhood. It's not how nice the home is that they grow up in. It's not how rich the neighborhood is. It is how cohesive the neighborhood is. It is the strength of the community around them. And so right now, our housing system is really driving people apart. It's driving communities apart. It's dividing us. And if we want to not just solve the housing crisis and build housing that actually, you know, is conducive to a sense of home, but also do things like tackle the loneliness epidemic and, you know, this wave of seniors, this aging population that we're about to hit, that we're already into right now, people who need care and people around them. If we want to start to patch together some of the political polarization that has started to take hold in our society and the breakdown of democracy, and even in some cases, I think the, you know, depression and anxiety that, you know, young people are having and the tendency to turn towards screens and AI and all that stuff. If we want to combat that the single best thing we can do is invest in socially cohesive communities that are working together. And that means giving people spaces to be with each other. And so that might mean a few less units in our housing, but maybe a courtyard where people can hang out. It might mean, you know, a little bit lower density, but we're still getting more housing in there than we would otherwise. But we also need to give people a job to do. People need to work together in order to build a sense of belonging and build a sense of community. And that's where I think our housing system, you know, and moving towards more community-led social housing, things like cooperatives and co-housing and community land trusts where the community is involved, is really integral because it's doing that work together that's not just going to come up with solutions that are sustainable, but it's actually going to build the community in the process. And that is going to help solve all manner of crises that we face, from, you know, climate change, the loneliness epidemic, to economic insecurity. It's bringing neighbors together that is going to have the biggest impact on our health as a society. And housing is such a great tool to do that, but it requires a rethink of how we approach it.
Jessica Barrett, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me about it.
Thanks so much, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Jessica Barrett is a journalist and the author of No Place Like Home, a book exploring the housing crisis, which is published by Penguin Random House Canada.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY in Nanaimo, on CFMH in St. John, on CFUV in Victoria, on Dig FM in the Comox Valley, and now on CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio.
On a stage nestled in the forest near South Wellington, a Vancouver Island theatre troupe is getting ready to take a story of the fur trade on tour. Reconciliation Theatre was founded in 2019 with the aim of putting on live theatre through a reconciliation lens. They're gearing up to put on Vancouver Island's first performance of Women of the Fur Trade by Anishinaabe playwright Frances Concan. I paid a visit to the cast and crew at a rehearsal just over a week out from opening night. Here's Tom Rokeby, the show's producer.
We've created this kind of inclusive company. We have a reputation for being a safe space and that we are committed to reconciliation. And so we're every year we're encountering new Indigenous artists that come and join our fold. You know, this year, Autumn is new to us. Daniel is new to us. Talayla is back after a couple of years of her other community leadership positions. But that's what really makes this a special experience, is that this process of creating an inclusive company that can actually produce the Indigenous works, because that's where we have a bit of an edge over other companies. Other companies have a hard time producing these plays because they don't really have Indigenous members in their company. So we're in a unique position to provide unique programming. So you asked the company earlier what they hope, one of the things that people get out of it. I hope that people kind of get out of this that all Canadians are experiencing a renaissance in Indigenous music and Indigenous writers, Indigenous movies. It exists in Indigenous theater as well. In Canadian theater, one of the most exciting and driving forces is Indigenous playwrights. And so we're really honored to be able to bring those stories to the Mid-Island and, you know, this summer, the entire North Island.
I also spoke with four members of the show's cast.
Hi, I am Daniel Kingshot, and I will be playing Louis Riel in Women of the Fur Trade. I was brought to this part because I am part Indigenous. I come from Metlakatla, Gispadwada, Killerwiller clan on the coast of Prince Rupert.
Hi, my name is Autumn Olenek. I am playing Marie Angelique in Women of the Fur Trade. Marie Angelique is a very bold and confident character. She does have a fascination with Louis Riel. She does send him love letters. She's into astrology. She knows what she wants, and I think she'll do whatever to get it, I guess. Yeah.
My name is Talayla Manson. I play Eugenia in Women of the Fur Trade. She is a Anishinaabe woman upon the banks of a reddish river. I am Stanaimuk First Nation as well as Tsleil-Waututh First Nation, which is on Vancouver Island, and the Burrard Inlet on the mainland in Vancouver. Reading the part of Eugenia, I instantly fell in love with this badass character that knew what she wanted and wasn't afraid to say what she had on mind. And she very much reminded me a lot of aunties that I have in my family. So I feel like that's the energy I'm trying to bring out in Eugenia.
My name's Kelly Rollins. I'm playing Cecilia in the play. I am an uninvited settler currently living on Stamenis First Nation territory. And Cecilia is also an uninvited settler. She's quite, she has a she's very naive and quite racist, but I don't think that she would describe herself that way. And I have been following Reconciliation Theater for a really long time and just noticed that a lot of my values seem to really align with theirs. I had read the play and fell in love with it. I think that it does a really good job of using comedy to talk about really important things and sort of call people in no matter where they are on their kind of unlearning journey. And I think Cecilia has a little bit of a journey herself throughout the play with the help of her two friends, Cecilia and Eugenia. And I think I hope sort of the people walk away from it with some learning and questioning their own understanding of Canadian history.
I wanted to early on address maybe where we're having this conversation. What does that environment do for you when you're rehearsing a play and it's a beautiful summer's day and it's in the middle of a forest and everything is beautiful except maybe the odd mosquito?
I think part of being able to do a lot of this production outside, especially on this stage that's in the forest, for me, I am in an area that my ancestors have been forever, and I'm starting to tell this story of early Canada. And I feel like being stuck in a building where I've done rehearsals and plays before, you don't get that same connection as like being on the land. And being outside, for me, has allowed me to get into the mind of Eugenia and what it would be like going on the land and experiencing early Canada. And then just the serene, I guess, nature of it has really helped me focus on this play and leave everything outside of it behind.
Yeah, it's beautiful, except for all the sunscreen and mosquito repellent that we needed to use. I've been working on my summer tan really fast, so my Métis tan coming on. It's really beautiful that we're just under all these trees, the maples, hemlocks, Douglas, and cedar giving you strength. I'm always so serene and calm. Like, I find working in a building kind of stressful and anxious because I have anxiety disorder. And just being out in nature just is so much more freeing. And I can just look up at the beautiful blue sky and sunshine. And it just brings in so much positivity into the space. So, and it's lovely working with all my friends here. And I get the most nature time I've ever had. Like 6 hours every Sunday. Like, we've been working on this, like, what, 22 hours a week. So it's been beautiful.
And beyond the like the play itself, maybe what is the experience of being in the play, of coming together and rehearsing so many times? What has that done or what has that been like for each of you?
It's been such a great experience. I love working with this cast, crew, our director, Lisa. Everyone comes in with such like a creative, what's the word? Creativity. Let's just say creativity. Everyone's so caring and thoughtful, funny, delightful. It's a safe space.
I think for me, I stepped away from theater for a few years just because I got so busy with everything else. But coming back into it, I realized why I fell in love with it in the first place. And that was this group of people coming together and all wanting to create something meaningful and put it on a stage for a crowd that can see our work. And in that process, I feel like we become a family in the end. And I get to see people that I've worked with in the past and get to meet more people on this journey to make this show possible. And it's just making community, and I think that's one of the reasons I fell in love and one of the reasons I don't think I'm gonna leave for so long again.
It kind of came full circle for me because about 5 years ago I went to Winnipeg, and I was at St. Boniface and I saw Louis Riel's tombstone, and I was like, whoa, this dude's kind of cool. And I'm also Catholic, so I also went to St. Boniface there. It was beautiful, whole French cathedral. We just listened to the whole mass in French. Kind of boring, had a little snooze. But it was just like, wow, this is full circle. I haven't been acting since 2018. I kind of lost the passion for it. Reconciliation Theater is a beautiful company, beautiful people. It's respectful. Yeah. And my growth and my passion has been created back on this stage, and I'm really grateful for that. And I'm really grateful because Louis Riel kind of feels like a part of me because I am half indigenous. So yeah, he just feels like he's in me, and I want people to see him.
I was new to the group and hadn't met anybody before. There are a few people that knew each other, but everyone's just been so welcoming, and it's been such a wonderful group to get to know and be a part of. And so I'm just really grateful that, that they've let me hang out with them.
The show's director, Lisa Rokeby, spoke with me about what it's been like working with the cast.
It's been very exciting because I was mentioning before that we all have a lot of work that we do during the day, and we're very exhausted by the time rehearsal time comes around. And then within 20 minutes of us coming together and getting started, you can just see the energy come alive. And suddenly, I'm not tired anymore. I'm not feeling stressed. It has been so wonderful to work with these people in a variety of ages as well. And sometimes we share sad stories, and often we're sharing funny stories. And every time we read the script, we're still laughing at the lines. And so Women of the Fur Trade is definitely a comedy, and but it is bringing in some really important pieces from history that can be difficult to digest. I really appreciate all of our cast members who have their own experiences with history and know how to be respectful with one another when we're working together. As Daniel mentioned, it's a very inclusive and safe space, and it has only wanted me to pursue theater more and work on more pieces with this group.
Reconciliation Theatre will be taking Women of the Fur Trade on tour with stops in Nanaimo, Courtney, Campbell River, Port Alberni, Euclulit, and Ladysmith. That's kicking off July 1st. You can find more info on their website, reconciliationtheatre.ca. That's it for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.